Hey everybody, my name is Vinoy Shaw, and I am an Al-Anon. Hi y'all. I certainly want to thank Harlan and the committee for inviting me. This is just so much fun, so great, so wonderful, and you've just been the kindest thing. I just love him. And most speakers, I know everybody that spoke so far, say that it's an honor and a privilege to be asked to one of these things. And I know the majority of these speakers here, and I know that's true for them. And I know it is for me. It is an honor to be asked, especially from somebody who actually knows you and will trust you enough to stand you up in front of a bunch of people. So thank you, Harlan. And I want to thank Chris for picking us up and being so kind. I sat here all week, it feels like a week, doesn't it? Have you seen so many speakers in your life? And this is the TV, I can see myself. Look pretty good. I came into this magnificent fellowship of ours February the 7th of 1969 in Lubbock, Texas. I don't think Matt's here. He's probably taking a nap. You know, this is nap time for most alcoholics. I appreciate y'all showing up. I have 41 years in the program. Thanks. I have a home group. It's called the Unity Group in Denton, Texas. I have a home group in Los Angeles that I've been in the last 20 years called the Stepped Up Group. Meets on Thursday nights. Unity meets on Tuesday nights. And I mean this sincerely. If you're in either one of those cities and would like a meeting, if you'll call me, I'll see that you get there or come get you myself. My open AA meetings, I went to the Pacific Group for nearly 20 years every Wednesday night. And now I go to some around. I haven't found the one that I was going to, the Big Book Group in Dallas. They had to discontinue the Saturday night meeting, so I'm looking around for a committed AA meeting, which is just as important to me as my Al-Anon meetings. I don't know what helped me the most in the beginning, listening to the alcoholics tell what was going on in my home, or listening to the people in that room tell my story. I don't know which helped the most, but God, I love being here. These speakers before me, I kept telling Harlan, I'm just going home. I mean, what could I possibly add here? Magnificent talks have been made in the last couple of days, and I know more are coming. It's just phenomenal to me. I've heard some of these speakers over and over and over, and truly, they made the best talks I've heard them. Carla, I told her yesterday, I think I've heard her so many times, and she was just exquisite yesterday. And I do believe it's because love has come into her life and it is shining through. That is, you're just such a beautiful woman. And Marnie just brings me to tears. I can just look at her and start crying because of how magnificent she is. I have a, yes, absolutely. I have a guest with me, a girl that I sponsor, Mary Alice. Mary Alice Virales from Dallas. And she'll have a year in Al-Anon next month. And she's the kind that you really kind of want, you know, that's a sponge. Her mother died of alcoholism. And she, being the oldest of the kids, it was her task to take care of the kids and her mom. So she has that thing going, and she's got a sweetie. Her God's will in her life is him, of course. And he's an alcoholic, go figure. And, you know, one of those moments happened last night that I just cherish them. Marnie was telling the story about being a drunk mother. and about her children, and about hitting the ground drunk, and her two boys meeting her at the airport, and them taking the two boys and leaving them. And then shortly after that, she said that there's, I don't remember what it is, there's enough wrenches to fit every nut. Is that it? That comes into AA? And when she said that, Mary Alice, just, you know, one of those laughters that come here when you hear the music of AA, it just, she started laughing and she turned and looked at me and those eyes were dancing. Those are the moments that I keep coming back for. And I thank you, Marnie. You did some healing last night for that young lady. And thank you, thank you, thank you. A little too many Catholics on this program for mine, you know. I was so glad to hear Matt. God, I love an alcoholic convict. I mean, that's my kind. And my friend, Marty, I can't wait to hear him. We've been trying to catch up over several years, and thank you, and I'm certainly looking forward to you. I'm glad you showed up, 2 a.m. That's tough duty. And I don't know why I'm doing all this, but anyway, I'll explain the speakers. You know, people get off work and get on a plane and fly all night, and come and just get into the rhythm, and you're just, you know, you come and you come and you come and you just sit and love and enjoy and have a good time and get back on a plane, get home at 10 o'clock at night and get up and go to work Monday morning. Thank you, all of you. Thank you for doing that. It's really hard. And the only perk that we get for doing it is getting a chair. Oh, dear. How do you thank somebody for your life? I'm from Lubbock County, and Lubbock County had absolutely nothing, just nothing, still has nothing. There was some cemetery where we hung out. We drove around and around the Heidi Ho Jr., just riding around the Heidi Ho Jr. That was basically it. I had three brothers, my mom and dad, and they were Southern Baptists, you know, the ones that were really going to heaven. And but my oldest brother broke his neck in a swimming accident when I was just a little girl. I don't even remember. I was 5 or 6. And we were in Oklahoma, and so they had to ship me back to Lubbock. And I started staying with friends and relatives because my brother just nearly died over and over and over. He was paralyzed, and my father lost his business because of this. And what church that I remember that we ever went to the wayside because they had to stay and take care of my brother. Everything was pretty much around my brother. When they did bring him home, they put him on a bed in a makeshift thing that my dad made for him. It was some pipes that they put on the foot of the bed and then cross, one pipe across. And then they had some straps that came down. They bored holes in his head, and they had tongs in there. And then this thing that held his head up for months and months and months so that spine could heal. And he had rotting flesh because of that. And then they packed this brown stuff in the rotting flesh. And it was actually rubber catheter that he had to wear. And there was no center air back then. I'm not going to tell you how old I am. Too bad, Matt. You're just going to have to guess. And and so when you walked in my house, it smelled really bad. All these different kinds of smells. And I did invite people over there. My mother and father fought all the time. Mother would take a bunch of Valium. It wasn't Valium then. It was, I don't know. It was a little green and black tranquilizers. I can't remember the name of them, but Mailtown. First ones that ever came out. Yeah. Thank you, Doug. Yeah, he got the right on that one, didn't he? Good luck, Carla. So that was the life that, and I would stay with these people out in the country, and way out in the country, and they didn't have, now this really sounds like I'm older than I am, but they did not have indoor plumbing at the time, because they lived way out on a farm. And so on Saturday night, she had three kids, and so she would turn all the burners on in the kitchen, and number 10 gray wash tub, some of y'all know what I'm talking about, big old gray wash tub, and fill it with water and bathe their kids. And then she would call me in there last. And I really, I did not want to get in that water. I looked at it, and she said, come on, it's your turn. That water was gray, and it had white stuff floating on the top. And just as I walked over there, she reached down the bottom of it and picked up this washcloth. And I stepped in, and she picked that washcloth up and started washing my face with it. And I remember that cold water hitting my face and thinking, I wish I could have some clean water. I wish it was in my bathtub. And then it was like, boom, oh well. What are you thinking? You know, this is fine. You don't deserve anymore. You may not even get to go back home. I didn't know if I was ever going to see my family again or not. I mean, I've been there for a long, long time. I did not know what was going on. And I carried that oh well until I got into an inventory. I didn't even know it was there. And when I got into that inventory, there it was. One of the starts of my not caring about myself, my low self-worth, that's where it started. How weird was that? So they did come home. I got with some older folks. They were, I don't know, 15 or so. And they introduced me to my next life, which was an West Texas honky-tonk. Oh, yeah. It was magnificent. I walked in, and it was so familiar. I mean, it was great. There was a big old ball, big old huge ball in the middle of this dance floor. And it had little mirrors on it, and a bunch of the mirrors had fallen out, so it was kind of, you know, mirrory and tiny. And then over here was a red light, and over here was a green one, and over here was a blue one, and I guess yellow, I don't know. But the lights would, in that ball, would look kind of like this thing. And the band was playing really loud, and it smelled like rotting flesh, old urine, smoke, stale smoke, and it was, oh, I am home. It was familiar. It was a place that I wanted to be. And they told me what to do. They took me over here, set me down. We watched the bands get started. We watched all the guys up on the counter over there, and they'd be drinking, and about 10-ish, they'd start falling off and sliding off those stools and looking over here at this side. And we would have already picked who we wanted out of the bunch over there. And you manipulate, and you get the guy, you know, God's will for you. You see him, that's going to be your savior right there. And you manipulate and figure out how to get him on the dance floor. And then that's when the games begin. I have a friend in the Pacific group, Catherine, and she said, and I told her, I wish I'd have thought about that. She would go to the bar, and she would find a table in front of the men's restroom. So when they opened the door, from the light from the men's restroom into the dark bar, would see her sitting there waiting. Isn't that a great idea? I mean, I never, ever thought about that. But we would get out there, and they showed me some steps, how to do it for my girlfriends before we ever got out there. So I get out there, and I start figuring it out. And then something happens that changed my life. You've heard it all weekend long, but this is just a little bit different of how you heard it. Every one of your speakers have talked about their drinking, their first drinks, what it did, how it changed them, what it was for them. And I know exactly what they're talking about. I know the feeling that they're talking about. And my first one came when this tall, good-looking guy. I had manipulated till I got him to the last dance. You have to be quick on the last dance. Those are important times. And Matt, I identify with the blonde women trouble. Had it all my life. You have to watch the blondes. The real ones. So you get him, you're on the dance, it's Sleepwalk. The last song is a Sleepwalk. It is just the most magnificent, a steel guitar, and it's one of those near. Oh man, I mean, today it gives me cold chills. And I would have him, and we would be in the stance, you know? I mean, I'm right here, and he's right here, and we're just, oh. You couldn't put a human hair in between us. I mean, we're just, oh. And he says to me, "Sugar, I need you." Oh, my God. Oh, I'm up, I'm on, yes. What do you need? I got it. I'm right here. I want your son's, the address, while I'm thinking about it, that how he looks up all your past history, all your, Matt, your felonies, he had a list of, and man, I would love to have that website. You know, I'm just saying. And I would take this person home with me or manipulate his place because, you see, I know now I'm going to be all right. This hole right here beside me is going to be filled, and I'm going to be all right. Other people will see me with him. They will think I'm something because I have a him here. I will do whatever he needs to keep him happy, to keep him there with me, because this is going to fulfill everything that I need. And I gave up things that I had been taught as a little child that you're supposed to keep. Little girls to do this, they don't do this, they don't do this, and they don't do that. Well, there's some of that that you really have to negotiate to keep your him. So my dreams are coming true. Here we are. Yay, I'm on the road. And the next morning, he disappears. I mean, just disappears. I've never figured that out exactly how that happens. Well, I'm hurt, of course, but oh, well, let's go back trolling. So I go back to the honky-tonk the next weekend, and we do this whole thing again. You know, I have my friends help me. They teach me all these things. I lay down on the bed. I get my jeans. They help me zip it up. Then they lift me up so that my jeans fit right, and I have the right dress and the right everything. You know, you got to look good, good boots. And we go back out there and start the process all over again. Until I just became a slut puppy hoe, to tell you the truth. I mean... But you see, my case was different. I was doing it because I really loved them. Because they needed me, I could help them. This boy just needs some love and some tenderness and somebody who understands him. And we can fix it. My dream was to have 2.4 kids, a station wagon with wood on it. Back then they had wood on it. My dream was to have a marriage like Doris Day and Rock Hudson. Yeah, and it always fell in front. I mean, it just went boom, went away. My first major, I've had three major alcoholics and a bunch of minor ones in between. My first major one. He was a professional gambler, and he was a bootlegger. He had runners, is what he called them, and they would go get whatever, and he had a house that he sold it out of, and he had people that sold it for him while he gambled. And he was a very fascinating man. He was also known as an insane man, like I've heard all weekend. I mean, he was pretty insane. He'd be the closest thing the way I could describe him is he was with like mafia type people. And one night I was out there. I wound up at a place called the Bloody Bucket it didn't open till like 2, and then it stayed till like 5 or 4 or 6 something. So we would go out there after the other ones closed, and I was up out there one night, and he threw a $100 bill on the table as he walked by and just kept walking. Now, I had never seen a $100 bill. I was in poverty most of the time because, like I said, my father lost everything when he was trying to take care of my brother and his medical bills. So a $100 bill really got my attention. And so I moved in with him. And now this was a shack-up job in the late 50s, which did not happen. It just did not happen. You were just blackballed from everything in the world. It just didn't happen. But I was doing it. And, you know, people came through there. There was a professional hitman, literally a professional hitman came through there. Prostitutes, pimps, they called them boosters. They would steal stuff and they would run it through our house and then go sell it. It was really a scary place. But I'm so stupid. I mean, I'm this idiot that, you know, was down from the west side. I didn't know what was going on. I had no idea. I was so naive what I was into. Nothing. I became pregnant by the gangster and unmarried, and which was certainly not done. When I went to the hospital to have my daughter, Tracy, he came to the hospital and he said, I've done everything I can do for you. You're going to have to get your things and make other arrangements how you're going to live. I've done all I can do for you. Well, they talk about alcoholism, the isms that make up the alcoholic personalities. And me and my sponsor, my grand sponsor, great-grand sponsor, they all talk about Al-Anon isms, if you will. The characteristics that I have that make me attracted to and will always be attracted to and always will go and find an alcoholic. That's who I am. I'm addicted to the alcoholic personality. I have a compulsion to run an alcoholic's life. And one of the reasons is because I know best. I mean, I just know best about everything. And I will tell you on a regular basis. I am controlling, of course. I am critical, of course. I manipulate, of course. I have expectations of how life is going to be, of course. So I have all these things going, and he tells me he's leaving me. What? You know, he was a violent drunk. All the drunks that I picked were violent drunks. Now, this man had shot at me. He had pistol whipped me. He had thrown me in cars that were stopped, out of cars that was running. I was running backwards over cotton rows. Some of y'all know what that means. You have to hit the top because they go like little valleys. I'd hit the top running backwards with him so drunk shooting at me that he missed me. And, I mean, this was the man that I loved. And he told me to get out. Well, now, he could do all those things to me, and I would stay. I would never leave, never thought about leaving. Don't reject me. Don't abandon me. Treat me any way you want to, but for God's sakes, don't abandon me. I can't handle that. I'm addicted to you. You cannot abandon me. So, of course, I had to do what he said, but then I put in a plan. What I will do is I will go with this guy that he hates. I will go and get him and manipulate him and get him to take me out to the bloody bucket in front of the gangster. The gangster's going to get upset, see how much he loves and misses me. He's going to come get me and bring us back home and say, oh, I'm so sorry, sugar, what was I thinking? Now, I was convinced of this, so I did this one night. And 3 nights later, they woke me up at dawn and told me that he had taken a gun and a shotgun and blew this man's head off. And he was in the hospital in a coma, and he did die. Now, when my friend came and told me that. Now, when she told me that, there was a pain that came in my chest that was so tight that was taking away my breath. My throat was closing. it was the sun was coming up. I'm telling you, I'm seeing it as exactly it was that night or that morning. And all of a sudden, this pain was all over me, and I noticed that the sun was going back down because everything was getting black, and the black was coming at me. And then it was like, whoa, whoa, you can't do this. And I, boom, just like that, took a deep breath, stuffed that feeling, and it stayed stuffed for many, 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 many years into this program. And I said, well, that's too bad. And, of course, a few days, of course, he died. Now, they took this particular situation and put it on the TV. They put it in the newspaper. It was all over the radio. They were going to clean up Lubbock from all this scum, blah, 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 blah. And my parents, who were so, they were so disappointed. I disappointed my family. They were ashamed of me and my actions. And my mother, do we have something you need to do? You have an emergency there? No? Then why are you bothering me? So when this murder came, my mother, who didn't like me, my mother didn't like me, and I didn't find out why until, I mean, like 30, 40 years later, I finally found out why my mother didn't like me. But she didn't. And so after this happened, I went over to my parents' house, and the screen door was latched, and my mother met me behind the screen. She said, "We do not want you coming in and out of this house. We don't want our neighbors to see you. And if anybody asks if you're our daughter, please tell them you're not." And I just said, "Okay, Mama." And that did not hurt my feelings. That did not make me feel bad, because it was the right thing to do. I had shamed my family. I had disgraced them with my needs that overcame everything that stood between me and my compulsion, my addiction, my man, whoever that might be, and whatever it took to stay there. And so I just turned and left, and I knew that was the right thing. Now, I must say, my daddy snuck around and got my daughter all the time. He loved my daughter, and he would come get her and take her, and then he would bring her back. I didn't get to see my mother. So here I am, a young girl. I've got this baby. What am I going to do? I don't believe in God. I mean, God's, I don't even know what that means. I read in, I think it was the Life magazine, there was a two-page spread, and it was in red letters. Somebody found it for me a few years ago and gave it to me. It says, "God is dead," question mark. And when I read that, I thought, I bet that's what happened, because they used to live a long time way back there in those times, so maybe there was God and he died, maybe that's it. But I had no concept of God, nor did I want one. So I'm standing there, what can I do? Well, I've got to do something. This is terrible. I can't stand this. And then it hit me. It was during the time when the people were tearing up their draft cards and burning the flags and all that. People were doing that except the Cowboys. They were not doing it. They were raising the flags, and they would talk about it, and they were good, clean, red-blooded, all-American boys. Of course, that's what I need, something clean. So I went over to the rodeo grounds, trolled over there for a while, and this is what happened. After the rodeo, there was a big concrete slab fence around it. All the cowboys leaned against this fence, all the cowgirls and us leaned against this fence, and about 10-ish, they started falling off the tent, the fence, and they'd come walking over, and we would get them, and then we would dance, and it would get closing time, and I'd get the blondes out of the way and get the... And I got the best bull rider you've ever seen in your life. I mean, he was way up there in the standings. He was great. I mean, he could ride a bull. And if he wasn't afraid of a bull, I mean, why wouldn't you fall in love with somebody like that? So our dance began. And one night he was, I don't know what we was fighting, but he was poking me in the chest. And our county was dry, so I picked up a quart, big old quart brown empty beer bottle, and just whopped him upside the head. And he fell, and I knew I was in trouble. I had done this before. And I turned and ran, and went outside, and he ran out and caught me. He spun me around, and he said, "You know what? I think you just knocked some sense into me. I think we should get married." Did y'all hear that? Married. Now, that had never come on my radar, marriage. I knew what I was. I am a piece of garbage. I mean, I'm a slut puppy hoe. I've heard what people say as I walk by their table. I hear what they say about me. And I have a child out of wedlock. My parents, I have hardly any friends left. And I know what I am. And I accept that. That's who I am. This is my life. And so marriage? Oh, my gosh, I'd never thought about that. Well, listen, he likes salted dogs. And I kept him so drunk on salty dogs the next 3 days while I drove him to get the marriage license, while I made the arrangements to go to my girlfriend's house, while I went and bought a cake, brought it over there, propped him up, got a justice of the peace to come over there, and that boy was married to me before he even knew what I'd do. Now I know what's going to happen too. Here's my dream. He's going to go to work. I am going to make little frilly kitchen curtains. I'm going to make some chocolate chip cookies. We're going to go to PTA. He's going to mow the yard. And, you know, we're just going to have this life. Now, I have no idea how to bake. I don't like to bake. And I don't know how to sew. We don't have a yard. But this is what this is my vision. This is my dream. So we rent this house. I send him off every morning a big, huge breakfast. He has eggs. He has pork chops. He has biscuits. He has gravy. He has some homemade jelly that I've stolen. He has whatever he needs. I make him a sandwich, and I put a little love note what's going to happen to him tonight when he gets in, and I wrap it up in some wax paper and stick it in the middle of his sandwich so when he's eating, takes a big bite in front of the big boys, and they see, oh, my little wife put this in. Woo, and he come in, there's chicken fried steak, and there's gravy, there's homemade bread, there's green beans that I just picked out, and there's a bath waiting on him, and pecan pie for dessert. I'm ready for my man. We had a great marriage. For the first 6 days was fabulous. Come the weekend, Charlie comes by, and he'll be right back. He and Charlie are going to go look at a fishing pole. He come back Sunday. That started for me what went on one day at a time for the next many years. Just many years. Watching, waiting, manipulating, barring the door, not barring the door, going finding him, not going finding him, having a son, waiting at the window, always waiting at the window. Took my position there. I could tell his pickup 6 blocks away. I knew the exact bling, ding, ding, bling, ding, ding that pickup made. I'd wait till 3 o'clock in the morning. I'd stand there and look and wait. And what is wrong with me? Why can't he love me? Why do I keep messing this up? What can I do different? What can I do? What can I do? What can I do? And I tried all sorts of things. Like I said, going to get him, not going to get him. One time I took this is the honest to God truth. There was a book came out, The Happy Hooker. And it had things that you could do. This hooker, I assume, wrote it. And you're supposed to get some feathers and some velvet and some bubble bath. And there was all kinds of instruction in there. And so one night I took my kids away and I made a dinner and had some candlelights on it. And, you know, the way she said to do it. I wrapped myself in saran wrap. It had just come out. It was this new thing. And I put 3 nice big bows on my body. And you can't sit down in saran wrap once you're wrapped in it. So I stood by the door waiting on him. Now, it's miserable. I mean, it is. Don't ever try it. It is miserable. It's too hot. You start sweating. He never showed up. And then there's how do you get it off? You know, it was don't ever try it. And I would have done anything for my addiction to be sitting on that couch so I can watch him. so I can talk to him, so I can ask him, what are you thinking? How are you? You feeling all right? Do you need anything? What can I do for you? You want a foot rub? Do you want some? What do you want? What can I do for you? Just, I'm addicted to him. I know when he's going to go out. By the way, he comes out of the bathroom from his shower. If his Levi's are unbuttoned and unzipped and he just comes casually in there and flops down the couch, he's staying in. But if his Levi's are zipped and the top button is open and he has his socks on, he's coming in there to pick a fight with me so that he can leave. Now, I know this as well as I know anything because I'm addicted to him. I know everything about him. Violent man. Fights. My kids, I kept them in the back bedroom. The neighbors kept their kids away from our kids. I never will forget when a lady shut the shade, that pulled the drapes when my son walked into the yard so her little girl wouldn't see him. I'll never forget that. How a lady said, no, my daughter can't babysit for your children anymore. It's too dangerous over there. How I felt when the police came and had to take me to the front door so I could get my children out of the house from this drunk man. I remember every one of those. Now, I'm thinking the kids don't see anything, though. They're too young. They don't know what's happening. They don't know what's going on because I kept in the back room. If they asked me what was wrong, I'd say nothing. Nothing. 1 Thursday. It was just Thursday. I was sitting in an old green rocking chair. I had 2 black eyes and a busted lip. He had worked out of town all week, and he was coming in the next day. And I was as done as you can be. The kids were in the back room being very, very quiet. You know, not because of him, the drunk, coming. They were being quiet because of me. They were terrified of me. They could always tell when their daddy was going to do something because they could smell him and watch him stagger. They could never tell when I was going to do something. Never. And I thought, I can't do this. Not, I can't. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? Well, prior to that, this couple of months, in a column, Ann Landers, a woman had written in about her drunk husband. And Ann Landers, I still to this day think, she said, call Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I did. And they gave me a number, and I called this woman. She talked for a few minutes and asked me to come over. And I went to her house. And once I got there, I discovered she was a sober member of AA. And shortly thereafter, her husband came in, and he was a sober member of AA. And they spent the next couple of hours talking to me. Now, that impresses me. I mean, they did not poo-poo me off because I was just an Al-Anon or just a wife. They sat and they talked to me. They told me their stories. They invited me to go to a meeting with them. And so February the 7th, 1969, they came by my house and took me to my first meeting. This is what I remember about that first meeting. It was really, really, really cold. And there was just rows and rows and rows of chairs. And the AA lady went in and sat down with me. Now I found out a couple of years later, she'd never been to AA Al-Anon meeting before, and she had never been since. But she took me to my first Al-Anon meeting and sat in there with me and introduced me to those women. And I remember looking at the coats all up and down the chairs. I was fascinated because none of the lining in the coats had safety pins keeping the lining attached. That's what I was thinking. Golly, no safety pins on their lining. They all must be really rich in here. Because my coat, my kids' coats, they had safety pins all up and down the back of them. And I left that meeting. And when I left, I knew I was going to be back. I don't know what was said. I have no idea what was said. I don't know what was said the first little while. But I knew that there was a feeling that I had when I sat in there that I really liked. When he took me, when that couple took me to my first meeting, the man got out of the car. He come around the back of the car, and we kind of met as I was coming out of the car, and we kind of met. Then he turned and he went to the door of the clubhouse. He opened the door, stepped back, and he looked at me. And I'm thinking, what's he doing? Why didn't he go in? And he's standing there with this door open. And I'm looking at him, and finally he goes, oh my God, he thinks I'm a lady. I had seen that in the movies. Men open the door for ladies. Oh my God, he's mistaken me. How embarrassing for him. And I walked through the door. When my feet walked into that room, it was a coffee room. And at the end of the coffee room was an old-timey cigarette machine. You put, I think, 35 cents in it. And pulled, and a pack of cigarettes would come out. And each of the front of the pack was a miniature and lights. And there was rows of them. And they were all different colors. And there was two guys leaned up against that thing. And they were laughing. And the lights were coming up, kind of glowing on their faces. And I stopped, and I was looking at those two guys because they were laughing. I hadn't heard laughter in forever. And this was real laughter. It was the music of AA, the first time I ever heard it. And it stopped me in the middle of that door. And in a minute, he said, let's go. And so I went on in. And sitting in those rooms for that hour, something was going on. Carla said it last night. And it's been, I think every speaker has said it. Carla said when she was in prison with those prisoners, she felt safe. She was a meeting inside of a prison with convicts, and yet she felt safe with those AA members. When I walked in that room and there was laughter in front of me and a gentleman behind me, I felt safe. God. I loved sitting in that room for that hour. I loved it, loved it, loved it. And I would sit right at the back of the room and just stay there. And as soon as they said amen, I was out of there because I didn't want anybody to know me because y'all were so clean. You were so pressed. And y'all didn't even say, can I say it? Shit. I mean, nobody said nothing. And it was like, oh my God. And then they talked about God. Now, I also heard at the same time, if God bothers you, put it on the shelf and just take what you need. Leave the rest of it. So I just need to come back, come back, come back. And slipping in and slipping out. I just didn't want y'all to know me. I didn't open my mouth, didn't say anything. Because if you knew where I came from, there was a possibility that you would ask me to leave. And I didn't think I could do it. I didn't think I could bear not coming back into that room. Well, after I'd been there for a while, this little teeny tiny lady went to this door. And this other lady went this other door because it had two doors. And they had decided that they were going to, before the Lord's Prayer, go out there and catch me. And I chose this particular door, and this little teeny tiny lady was standing there. Her name was Pat Clater. And she said some things to me that only she could say and only I could have heard that night. We called it many times that divine appointment that God has set up for you a long time ago. And she became my sponsor, and she was my sponsor for 40 years. She died last year, and it's been one of the biggest losses that I've ever experienced. Sponsor is such a treasure. Somebody that will actually listen to you, actually take the time to guide your life, actually take time, because they call me, to listen and say, well, this is what I did. Won't you try this? I mean, that is so glorious. And to be able to sit in a room with a sponsor, it's just magnificent. Sidebar, I asked Nell L. from Warwick, Oklahoma. She is now my sponsor, and she's taken on my case. And I think she may have some problems. She keeps telling me she read this about ego and read that about ego. And she must really have a problem with her ego, or she's trying to tell me something. I don't know, you know. And Pat bought me a One Day at a Time book. It had just come out. It had come out, I think, October of 68, and it was a new book, and she gave it to me. And she bought me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, we're going to read this book, and you're going to discover what alcoholism is. And we're going to read it and see, take it home and read the stories in the back. And I did. I went home that night, and I read all the stories in the back. That was the first thing I read. And it was just, it was unbelievable. They were talking about drinking like it was going on in my house. And they invited me to those open AA meetings. And when the speakers would get up, they were talking about what it was like. That was what was going on in my house. And I started understanding. And I really, really, really got it. One night when my cowboy come home, we were having a pretty nice weekend. And it was Sunday. And he said, I'm going to run out to so-and-so. I'll be back here in just a little bit. And I really believed he'd be back in just a little bit because we was having one of those weekends. And he didn't come in until like, I think, 9 o'clock that night. And when he walked into the den, he had his head down like this. And he said, I'm so sorry. Then he raised it up, and he just started lambasting me, screaming and yelling, what an idiot I was, blah, blah, blah. I got it. It was like, that's what they're talking about. He does not know why he did what he did, and he is at me. And so I got it. I really got a piece of the puzzle that night, that this is alcoholism. And I have Al-Anonism, and we just match. And there's no blame there. It's just what it is. Alcoholism is the only disease known to man that affects those who don't even have it, I heard a man say from this podium. Now, that's what this is. And it started me looking at him totally different. These people helped me with my kids. I started going to these meetings. He started kind of backing off. And then he tried to stop me from going to the meetings. That's when the police showed up to help me get my kids out. I had been going about a year. He went to a conference with me, and he stayed so sober for 6 months. And then he decided he wasn't really, really an alcoholic and quit going. Now, the minute I walked into AA, and I got to knowing some of these gentlemen, the men of AA, I love the men of AA. I love them. They treated me with respect. They treated me with kindness. I was never misused or abused. I love them. And one of them, his name was Bedford, he said to me one time, you know, if you clean up your mouth, the men would respect you a bit more. Oh. Jack said, you know, if you'd wear jeans that actually fit, you'd look a little better. All those kind of things started happening. It was incredible for me. Bedford said to me, why don't you try keeping your mouth shut? Now, I had never really thought about that. I hadn't. I thought I'd explain to him everything that, because I know best, and I know, you know, I could tweak things if he'd let me. So I really and truly started keeping my mouth shut. And 7 years later, I'm still going to the program. He's still drinking. His drinking getting worse. My self-worth, which I've always and still do have problems with. And he came in one night, and I knew it was like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. He hadn't laid a hand on me since I walked in 7 years earlier. He came in, and I knew he was in a blackout. The door shut. He walked in, you know, slamming those boots down. He flipped on that light. He reached over, and he just started whacking me. And I was trying to get away from him. I was all caught up in the sheets, and I stumbled, and I fell, and I hit the floor, and my face hit the floor like this and bounced me back up, and I looked right into the door. And there was my two kids screaming, Daddy, please don't hit her anymore. Please don't hit her anymore. And I saw my kids. I saw their face. I saw, good gosh, what are they living in? Good gosh. And, you know, that clarity, if you will, came. And I got my children, I got myself, and we got out of there. Now, I'm a high school dropout. I have no way of supporting me and these kids. When people would ask me, why do you stay there? I say, I'm not staying here. As soon as I get some money saved, I'm leaving. As soon as the kids get out of school, I'm out of here. As soon as I get the car paid off, I'm out. I'm not staying here. As soon as. And one of them was, I really didn't know how I was going to take care of us. But that night, none of that mattered. I left. And as soon as I left, guess what? All kinds of things started happening. I was given an old car. I got into nursing school. Now, I never dreamed about being a nurse. I get car sick. I couldn't imagine being a nurse. But my sponsor had been a nurse, and she said something to me, you would probably make a good nurse. And the next thing I knew, a friend of mine was worked for the state welfare, and he came and said, why don't we do this for you? And another guy in AA came and said, I work for the rehab, let's do this. And before I knew it, I was enrolled in nursing school. And I remember that first day sitting there, I don't know a thing about how being a nurse. How can I stay here? And then it dawned on me, I'm in nursing school to learn how to be a nurse. Keep your seat. And when I graduated from that nursing school, and it was very difficult. I was on welfare, and I didn't want to be on welfare. I was ashamed of it, embarrassed about it. I got food stamps, and I had to go downtown and to the warehouse and get stuff, and it was really embarrassing. And my sponsor said to me, you know, you don't know what God's got in store. Just do what you're supposed to do. And so I graduated, and there in this big, huge room was my mom and daddy sat there. And the class asked me to give the class response. And my mother had invited the neighbors to come and see me graduate. And I was giving the class response, and I looked down there, and my dad was looking at me, and then he looked at Mr. Stewart and said, pointed back, that's my kid up there. You know, and all, you know, they were smiling. They invited the neighbors because you taught me, my sponsor taught me, conventions taught me, being of service taught me, sponsoring other people taught me. You make verbal amends and then you make living amends and you wait and see what God does with it. And he put us all back together and there they were. I divorced that cowboy. That was hard because I didn't want some other woman to get all the good stuff, you know. But I divorced him. And I was a single mother. It's hard. It's really hard if you're a single mother today and you have kids and you're trying to do this deal. Do you stay home with the kids or do you go to a meeting? Do you keep your kids the weekend or do you go to a convention? And this is what I was told over and over. If I'm not a good mother, if I don't stay in these meetings and go to conventions and do service work, the kids are not going to have a mother anyway. So I started a new life, single life. My daughter was a teenager at this point, and she went to bed one night, just the cutest little teenager you've ever seen in your life, and I tucked her in, and he was all snuggly, and she got up the next morning, and she was a potential alcoholic. And I was not going to have that. I'm the mother, you're the child, you will not be an alcoholic, that's it. And the fight was on. She was in and out and in and out and stealing and sneaking and in and out. And we fought and we fought and fought and kicked her out, brought her in, go to Thor. And I finally figured out it was her task, not mine. My son, they called me from school one day. He was 11. And they said, your son, we caught him in a closet with another kid, sniffing Pam, you know, that you cook with, Pam. Out of a empty paper towel holder. Pam? What? So I went and got him. He, you know, he's really pale, so I took him to the doctor, and they did everything. I was taking him home, and I said, son, why in the world did you do that? And he said, well, Mama, I like the way it makes me feel. Well, I had heard you talk enough that I thought I'm in trouble, so I was going to put him in a boys' ranch down in San Angelo, Texas. I already had a job set up there. And his still drinking daddy found out about it and came and kidnapped him. I didn't know where he was for several days. The sheriff was out. We were hunting him everywhere. And my son called me and he said, I'm okay. I'm staying with my daddy. I want to live with him. I'm not coming back home, and just slammed down the phone. Well, I was just devastated after all I had done for these kids. So I went to my sponsor, and we talked about this, and I had to write an inventory on my motherhood, and I found out I was a bad mother on many, many levels. I was a bad mother. I found out I was a good mother on many, many levels. What was going on in my home was the disease of alcoholism and the disease of Al-Anonism, and that was what was going on, and that there is no blame. God has no grandchildren. And she told me to take my kids and to put them in God's hands and go to prayer and meditation and put them in God's hands. And so I did. We had started going back to a church, gotten very involved in the church, took my kids to church. And there was a kneeling rail there, and you could go down there and you could pray. And the elders would come and pray with you. And so we went down there, and my prayer and my kids and I had gone down there, but this particular time, it's my prayer and meditation. And we go down there, and I'm kneeling with them, and I put their hands together, and I backed off. And I let the elders and God take my kids in my meditation. And truly, as well as I possibly could, one day at a time, I have left my kids in God's hands. Now, that doesn't mean I don't grab them back, because I do. But the concern and the worry and the terror about my kids' life, and my sponsor said, "What got you to this program?" I said, "Pain." She said, "What do you think is going to get your kids to this program?" I thought, "Oh, pain." You can enable them, or you can let them be and have their own discovery about their diseases and what's going on with them. So one day at a time, I've tried to do that. Now, what it's like today, I didn't know I was spending this too much time. I hate this. You just get caught up. I get caught up with the magnificence of my own voice. I just go off because I want to tell you what it's like now. I was divorced. My daughter was off. She was in college. My son is living with his daddy. I'm single, so I'm running around, and I go to a convention in Midland, Texas, and Clancy came back there to speak, and one of his people that he sponsors was there, and this guy's name was Jim Shaw, and I was introduced to Jim, and he had this big, deep voice and these big blue eyes and gray hair and lots of diamonds. All the above caught my eye. One particular thing, the diamonds. And so we started having a long-distance relationship, and we decided that I would move out to California where he was. He was going to rent me an apartment. We were going to try to put it together. Yay, that sounds great. So I quit my job, packed everything in a little U-Haul trailer. One of my friends was going to drive me out. Jim was going to fly him back. Jim was off at a cruise. I go off and tell everybody how magnificent this program is. I fly in on Sunday. I get off the plane, and there stands Jim. I thought, oh, he can't wait for me to get out there. He come get me. And he dumped me right then and there. He said he'd got in touch with his feelings, and he just couldn't go through with it. Now, I have to say this. I don't really particularly like to, but I have to. He did give me a lot of money to get my life put back together, which still makes me mad that I have to tell that. So I went right back, got my apartment right back, got my job right back, got everything back. But let me tell you, I was just devastated, total despair. Not at Jim, but at God. It's like, all this good stuff's happened to everybody I know, and what's wrong with me? Why can't I get the good stuff? What is this? I've done everything you've told me to do, God. I've gone to meetings. I've sponsored people. I've made the coffee. I've swept. I've sponsored these weirdo people that you sent to me. I've been DR. Oh, my God. I've gone to those assembly meetings. I have done everything. What is it that you want from me so that I can do like everybody else does and get the miracles of AA and Al-Anon? What did I do wrong? Well, let me tell you something, God, screw you. And I'll do it my way. And I went down to the club, and I was sitting there, and this newcomer guy walks in. Old ideas came in. A couple of weeks later, another newcomer guy come in. Old ideas take in. And I'm as ashamed of that as I know how to be. And I was went to a little conference, and my sponsor was there, and the caretaker of the conference came and handed me a note, and I opened the note up with my sponsor sitting right next to me, and it was a man's name and a phone number, and she looked at me, and I thought, I am so busted. And I was. I was busted. So she asked me, we got late at night, she said, "What is going on with you?" And I said, I feel like, and I told her, I said, I feel like God has betrayed me. And she said, "Do you think you ever betrayed God?" And I don't know why that one sentence changed my life, but it changed my life. And I said, "Pat, there's something I need to tell you that I've never told you. I've never told a soul. I've never even let it out in the sunshine. But this is the truth about me. I am unlovable. People love me for a while, but they always leave. My mother doesn't even love me. You know, my dad, he left. My brothers left. My brother, Jimmy, never spoke to me. He didn't speak to me for years. He wouldn't let his kids come. I couldn't be invited to his home. My whole family go to his home, and me and my kids couldn't come. I'm unlovable, and I don't know why. I've done everything I know to do." And I started sobbing. You know, one of those sobs that comes from your toes out? And my little teeny tiny sponsor grabbed me, and she put my head on her shoulders, and she started patting me, and she started rubbing my hair and back and forth and rocking. And she said, "Oh, that's not so annoying, because I love you. And I know all your warts. And if I can love you the way I do with my human love, can you imagine how much God loves you?" And I heard it. I don't know why I heard it that day, but I did. And on the way back, I was looking out the window, and I said, "God, if you'll let me go back and mop the floors, if you will let me go back and make the coffee, whatever you ever ask for me from this day forth, the answer is okay. Whatever it is, the answer is okay. Because I need to be here more than any place I know. I can't exist without you people. I just can't do it." So I went back and started doing the things that I knew, like I was when I was new, like Matt so beautifully said it earlier today. I started doing the things, and I'm still doing them today, all those things. And slowly, slowly, God came back in my life. And a few years later, Jim came back, exactly 2 years actually later, Jim came back in my life. And this time I caught that sucker before he could even take a deep breath. I had him. He brought two kids. We got married in 1982, and he brought Sheila and Jimmy into my life. And we set up housekeeping in Norman, Oklahoma. We were there for a while. My daughter called. She had tried to commit suicide, drunk. And Sheila called. She was walking the streets of L.A. She had a child out of wedlock, which I was able to help Jim with. And she said she was going to put him in a foster home, my little grandson, Brad, because that's how she had been raised. And I said, "Jim, we can't let that happen. I know this is a cry for help. Let's send for her." So he bought her a one-way ticket back to Oklahoma. He very begrudgingly did that. And she got off that plane drunk with my little grandson, Brad, and we took them in. And a few months later, my daughter called and said, "Are you coming to the..." I went back every summer to Lubbock for our hometown convention. I said, "Yes." She said, "Can I meet you down there?" I said, "Sure." So she came and sat with me at a convention in Lubbock, Texas, and she found her sobriety. The most amazing person, Father Leo. Have y'all ever heard of Father Priest? She heard a priest, and he told her story. That's just, that's something wrong about that. And a few months later, my daughter, Sheila, was sitting in the back of the room. She had lost my grandson. She didn't know where he was one night, and her roommate found him. And the next day, she came because she looked in those kids' eyes. And she has 25 years of sobriety. My daughter, Tracy, got sober, stayed sober. She met man on AA campus. They got pregnant. They got married. They got divorced, and Jim and I got them. And so I have a granddaughter, Sharday. My granddaughter, Sharday, and my grandson, Brad, are both alcoholics. Duh. Jimmy Jr. has my grandson, Marcus. He's an alcoholic. That brother who never spoke to me killed himself drunk one night, and he has a daughter, Tanya. And my two girls, when my daughter had 1 year sobriety, we went back. Sheila had 10 months of sobriety. And my two girls, we went and got Tanya, who found out, my niece, that I was going to be in town. Tanya called my mother. We went and got her, brought her to my mother's house. And my two daughters dressed her up. And one of those touching things, I was standing there watching, and Sheila did nails. And she said, "I'm going to do your nails." And Tanya just turned pale. And she said, "Wait a minute, let me go to the bathroom." And she went in there to wash her hands. She said, "My hands are too filthy for Sheila to touch." And those girls dressed her up and took her to her first AA meeting. It's incredible stuff. Incredible stuff. You talk about the age of miracles. Those were the ages of miracles for me. We raised Brad for the first 5 years. Jim and I got to raise my granddaughter, Sharday, for like 10 years. God gave us another chance. Do you hear what I'm saying? I mean, I was a terrible mother. He was a terrible father. He abandoned his kids. But God gave us all grandkids so we could do some payback. And we got to help with those kids. It's marvelous feeling. My big old huge Jim Shaw, this deep voice, would go down to school and put a Santa Claus suit on to the kids' school, and he would carve out pumpkins. This is a big old drunk man. I mean, he was just fantastic. We moved back to California. We were out there for quite some time. Jim had to get his business back together, and while we were out there, Jimmy Jr. Come to work for his daddy, drunk all the time. They never got together. It just was terrible. And one day, Jim says, "My shoulder hurts." 13 years ago, next month. He said, "My shoulder hurts." He went to the doctor, and 3 months later, he was dead. Had cancer. It was all over him. And you know, even in those worst times, Jim taught me so much. He was such a good man. And he taught me so much. Now, he was no saint, let me tell you. He and I could clear a room in 5 seconds. We fought like cats and dogs all the time. But this cool art, I'm used to violence, and he is too, so we just brought it in wherever we went. So he was dying, and he taught me so much. And this brief little thing about that. I was crying one night in the middle of the night. I couldn't sleep. And he came in, and I was sitting on the couch and just crying, and he picked me up and put his arms around me. He's patting me. He said, "What's wrong?" I said, "I just don't want you to die. I'm just going to miss you so much. I'm just sobbing and sobbing." He said, "Well, you want me to figure out a way to take you with me?" I said, "No, I'm not going to miss you that much." And the next day, a couple of his buddies came, and they wanted to take him out on the golf course. We were living in Palm Springs at the time, and we had we lived on a golf course, and he was in the back room sleeping. And I said, "Guys, he can't go. He had a bad night, and he just can't go." He said, "Well, can we go see him?" Jack was his best friend. I said, "Sure." So they went back there, and in a minute, I heard the back door slam. Yeah. So I went back there, and sure enough, Jim's gone. I run to the front door, open it up, and there they got him with a hood over his head, his oxygen tank beside him, and they're in their cart, and they're taking him off, and I'm sitting out there screaming, "Bring him back, he's dying. Bring him back, he's dying." Jack says, "He ain't dead yet." Like this. And Jim came in and one night, and we were sitting there talking, and he said, "You know, we talk a lot about the 11th step around this program." He said, "I'm living it." He said, "God, I have asked God in my prayers what I'm supposed to do, and this is it. And I'm asking him for the power to carry it out." And he said, "He's given it to me," because we were surrounded. You know, when one of us is wounded, you know, you can't wade through the people that come to support you. And so he did die. I discovered when he died that we had been embezzled, and I lost everything. Lost my home that was paid for there in Palm Springs, lost everything, lost the trucks, they were gone, everything, and never to be found, did find the trucks, but they were stripped, and a few months after that, my daughter tried to commit suicide sober. She was 10 years sober, and she tried to commit suicide, and, you know, I don't know how you know, but you look sometimes in the light of their eyes. You know, it's happy joy. Like I saw Mary Alice's last night. I saw such joy pop out of those eyes. It was one of those moments you just want to see, is that joy. And that joy had gone from my daughter Tracy's eyes. They were gone. And sure enough, shortly after that, we gave her a 10-year party, and she tried to commit suicide, and she drank. Got sober again. She had 2.5 years. She moved over to Phoenix, and she called me one night. We had gone to Lubbock for Christmas, and she called me, she said, "Are you sitting down?" Now, please, you don't want an alcoholic daughter to say, "Mom, are you sitting down?" I said, what are you talking about? She said, well, I just ran off to Vegas and got married. I said, to who? I mean, I didn't know she was dating anybody. Well, I knew the guy. He was a hairy-legged kid that we'd all grown up with. And I said, well, are you going to live there in Phoenix or are you going back to Texas? And she said, well, we have to get back to Texas before his parole officer finds out he's out of state. So naturally, she drank again. And she was living in a tent in front of a mobile home in a trailer park. And he had just run off with a redheaded stripper. And she went to a bar and she got beaten so bad that she does not, they took her to the emergency room and she was there all night. And she didn't know a soul to call, not a soul. And she called her sister, Sheila, my Sheila, and Sheila told her to meet her at this Tyler, Texas. The next weekend I was coming there and Sheila was coming there, and so my daughter came, and I had to look at two black eyes and a busted lip in my daughter. And, you know, AA took her in. Those girls gathered my daughter up. It was just incredible. And my daughter now has 11 years of sobriety in Phoenix. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I got to be with her. I got to be with Tracy. I got to be with Sheila when they came to this program. My granddaughter, Sharday, 2 years ago, we were riding around the country, and she said, Grandma, I got something to tell you. And I said, what? She said, I think I'm an alcoholic. I said, oh, really? She said, will you go with me to tell Mama? I said, oh, God, I'd love to. So we went and told Mama, so I got that. My Brad is in and out, in and out. He's not sober. Marcus, my Jimmy son, they're in and out. And you know, those little treasures that you get. Somebody said, how are your grandkids? I said, boy, they're great today. I know where both of them is. One's in jail in Los Angeles, and one's in jail in Norman, Oklahoma. They're going to be there all weekend. It's great. I know exactly where they are and how they're doing, you know. But they've all been to you. My brother has two kids that are alcoholics, and a couple of weeks ago I was in Midland, Texas, and my little niece came and said, can I go with you? So she spent the whole weekend with me, and a man named Roy Bell grabbed her up. So now my brother, his family has been affected by you. Every member of my family has been here to you, every one of them. And there is such relief in that, I can't even explain it, because y'all got their back, and I don't have to worry about them. Even those who come in and out, I know they'll be back. So everybody, y'all have gotten everybody. How can I thank you? How can I say thank you for my children? Thank you for my life. Thank you for them. My God, I mean, it's just overwhelming to me. You need me to come? Okay. You need me to make coffee? Okay. I'll do whatever. My grand sponsor, her name is Marcy White, and her husband was Bob White. And Bob spoke at a conference that Jim and I started in Oklahoma, and Bob was a Sunday morning speaker, and he said this that morning. He said, we close every meeting with the Lord's Prayer, and it starts off with Our Father. And then it says the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. He said, any school kid knows if there's a kingdom and a father, then that makes us a prince and princess of the kingdom. Now, wow, how great is that? I've always had trouble with my self-worth. I've always had trouble with, is it really going to happen to me? You know, I'm hearing these speakers. You know, Matt got his house paid for. I lost my, what am I doing wrong? I've been wanting a job, you know, of 3 days a week. Can't get it. I'm living in a room with some people. I don't have a house. I don't have my own place. You know, where is the age of miracles? And I've heard it over and over and over this weekend. This is a safe place to be. God does it. God does it. God does it. And Bob says the miracle is we are prince and princes of the kingdom. He says, claim your heritage. And I thought, yeah, that's right. I am a child of God. I got to remember that. And I got to treat you like that. And he said, the power is in these rooms. We give it to each other whether we know it or not. And the glory is God himself. So that's my self-worth. I know what it is. This is still the age of miracles. I am Princess Vinoy. I'm a child of the King, and that's the heritage that y'all have given me. Thank you so much for my life.